Well, good evening. Welcome back to our study of the book of Daniel. Glad you guys are here. Thank you for joining us online. As usual, kind of housekeeping, those of you online should have a handout online and the number should be on it for texting your questions during class. So if you have questions, text them in. We try to get as many in as we can. So this is one of my favorite stories in Daniel. So I'm really excited to get into it. But let's say a prayer before we start. Lord, thank you for bringing us together. We're grateful that we live in a country where we can come to study your word freely. I pray, Father, that we would take this in our minds and let it drift into our hearts to know that you are trustworthy. And I pray that it would come out through our mouths and hands to be bold to speak your truth for the good of those around us. I pray for our world. I pray for peace. I pray that you would turn the hearts of leaders to you. We know that you are sovereign in all things, and we trust you in Christ's name. Amen. Well, if you remember, the book of Daniel's divided into two. It's almost like two different books. So the first six chapters are, in chronological order, events in the life of Daniel, a remarkable life. And we will do the sixth story in our next lesson. And then we'll have 1 week off because of fall break, and it's hard to run a kids' ministry during fall break. And then we'll come back and do the second half of the book, which is like a different book. It's just all prophecy. So we're going to really geek out on prophecies and multiple fulfillment and end times and just pretty much figure out whether you should buy gold or not buy gold. We'll let you know how close we're getting to the end. I notice when times are hard, gold goes up, so we'll hopefully give you some guidance on that. So here's a recap, and one of the reasons we do all this history is if you just go over it every week, it will be in your mind. If you remember chapter 1, Daniel and his three friends, I'm just going to call them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which are their Babylonian names. But Daniel and his three friends, 605 BC, it's a matter of historical record, they're taken to Babylon. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, who's the king, who destroyed Jerusalem and deported a lot of their people, he has a dream, and none of the wise men can figure it out, and Daniel figures it out in chapter 2. Chapter 3, he builds the big golden image, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won't bow down to it, if you remember, and throw them into the furnace, and God delivers them. Chapter 4 was Nebuchadnezzar, time is moving on. Nebuchadnezzar, near the end of his reign, because of his pride, he loses his reason. And for 7 years, he loses the throne, so to speak, and God restores him when he repents. And then in this lesson, we're in chapter 5. Chapter 5 is interesting because chapter 5 is right at the end. Nebuchadnezzar has died. Daniel is still alive. And we are right at the end of the Babylonian Empire. And we know, in fact, we know the exact day that chapter 5 happens. It's a matter of historical record. It's easy to figure it out. So we know the exact day. But what's really interesting about chapter 5 is it's historically very reliable to know that you had from 605 BC to 562 BC, Nebuchadnezzar reigned. 562 to 560, there were three different guys, and they kept killing each other off. It had three different kings in 2 years. And then the last king of Babylon, a guy named Nabonidus. And so that's all fine. He was king all the way until Babylon was overthrown, which is going to happen tonight. The problem is chapter 5 isn't about Nabonidus. There's another king called Belshazzar. And so for a long time, people said, obviously Daniel is made up because everybody knows, and the historical record shows, we know all of the kings of Babylon, and Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. Until, this is why you should never argue against archaeology, all right? Until the late 1800s, when these what are called the Nabonidus Chronicles, were dug up, a collection of 45 tablets that were unearthed. And these tablets talk about the whole Babylonian reign. Talk about Nebuchadnezzar, and they talk about Nabonidus, but one of them mentions Nabonidus and his son, Belshazzar. Well, in chapter 5 of Daniel, Belshazzar is the guy. And then they realize, oops, looks like the book of Daniel's right. He was the son and the co-regent with his father. So according to the Chronicles, he was actually the one ruling in Babylon while dad was off 500 miles away. And so I would just want you to know that for a long time, and if you read, you probably don't read ancient commentaries, you know, in the 1800s, but at that time, it's like, Bible's not reliable. But the more you unearth, the more it becomes clear the Bible actually is exactly reliable. And in fact, this is kind of important because the idea of Nabonidus as the last king, but really it was his son Belshazzar that was ruling when they were overthrown, that's a little historical fact that is really hard to know unless you were there at that time. Does that make sense? There's certain things in the Bible that add a lot of veracity, and this is one of them. Because in this few hundred years after these events, this is going to happen in 539 BC. In the few hundred years after that, it's easy for historians to forget little details like that. That still happens with us. Every now and then you'll see a new book published. Somebody's found some new records from, the Revolutionary War in America and realized, wait a minute. There was this character who did something in the American Revolutionary War, and we just didn't know it because we hadn't read the records. So that happens a lot. So the fact that chapter 5 is talking about Belshazzar is really indicative of the veracity of the Bible. So it opens with the line, King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. So this is a massive feast in Babylon. Now, his father Nabonidus is alive, but he's not in Babylon. Belshazzar is ruling as a co-regent, co-king in Babylon. So let's get the time down just a little bit. So chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is probably 603 BC. Chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar kind of goes crazy, is probably 570 BC. And this chapter, chapter 5, is 539 BC. In fact, it is October 12th of 539 BC. We know this because this particular event is very well attested. Not only do you have the Babylonian cuneiform tablets that I showed you, but in the next century, in the 5th century, Herodotus, the Greek historian, writes about this. And in the 4th century, Xenophon, who's another Greek historian, writes extensively about this. So there's a lot of extra biblical information about the events in chapter 5 of Daniel. So we basically have moved through time. So from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you get 33 years, right, between chapter 3 and 4. And now we have another approximately 31 years between chapter 4 and chapter 5. Nebuchadnezzar has died, a few other kings, Nabonidus and Belshazzar. And in 539 BC, things are not going very well. The Medes and the Persians, who think east of there. Persians are Iranians. The Medes are in northeast. Think some of the stans today, you know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. I just call them the stans. No offense, just that whole group of stans there. And so that up in that area. So those two people groups are forming a kingdom, and they're invading Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was a great king. Everybody after him, not so much. Probably could have used a little Pete Hegseth pep talk because their military, just not good. They're going downhill after Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, before this night, a few days before this evening, Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, had led an army in the field against the Persians and the Medes and was defeated. And Nabonidus fled. And so the Persian and the Medes, their army, march up to Babylon. They are currently encamped outside Babylon on this night. And Belshazzar says, what a great time for a party. So major denial. It could have been a religious festival. It's hard to know. I think it's more likely that he said, look, you guys can camp out there all you want to, but we have impregnable walls. And I've shown you that before, and I'll show you again at the end. And they did. 40-foot high walls, multiple walls, very, very difficult to conquer this city. And I think Belshazzar said, I'm just going to sit here and wait you out. They have water because the river Euphrates runs right through the city. So it's not like you don't have water. You can hold out indefinitely. So I think he's just thinks that there's no way you guys can conquer Babylon. So I think I'll just have a party instead. So he's having this big party, and it says, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father — Nebuchadnezzar is his grandfather, but that's just the way they spoke — that Nebuchadnezzar, when he destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, he took all the golden goblets and all the objects and brought them back as a tribute. He said, why don't you bring those out? He bring them out, and the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. In other words, they're basically using the utensils of Yahweh, the name of God of the Jews, and they're drinking to the health of their idols. If you wanted to make God angry, you probably couldn't do better than this, right? And so we've seen through the life of Nebuchadnezzar how he came to understand that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is a powerful God. Well, Belshazzar probably apparently was not paying attention because he has forgotten that. And so one of the themes that runs through the Babylonian Empire, but also runs through the book of Daniel, is this idea of pride. There's some really interesting passages here, and you're going to see it all through the Bible. And Babylon and the idea of pride, being proud and flaunting your pride in the face of God, is a theme that's going to run all the way to the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, which we will study later in this series, you're going to see Babylon associated with the pride of humanity saying, I don't need God, I can do this myself. Well, that's Belshazzar. Of course, in Proverbs, you get this beautiful proverb that pride goes before destruction. Romans chapter 1, when the Apostle Paul's talking about the gospel, he said the problem is that people have turned their back on God and taken pride in themselves. Claiming to be wise, they instead became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. Now, we don't worship images per se. We worship other things, but it's the same pride, and it's the same idea. That's a universal human temptation. This is an interesting little passage in Isaiah. So this passage, Isaiah, think of Isaiah as written about 700 BC. And just remember, we're at 539, so this was written ahead of time. This is in the middle of a prophecy 160 years earlier, where Isaiah says, Babylon the Great is going to be destroyed. That was before Babylon was great. And he's prophesying, and he says, Babylon's going to be destroyed. And he's prophesying about the king of Babylon. Doesn't name him. But clearly, this prophecy comes true in Daniel chapter 5 in 539 BC. So in this passage, he's talking about the king of Babylon. But Jewish commentators and Christian commentators also see in this a description of Satan. In fact, this is where you get the name Lucifer from the Latin translation of this. So the word Lucifer comes from this. So listen to this. How you are fallen from heaven. Now it's hyperbole. You know, obviously the king of Babylon wasn't the king in heaven, but he thought he was, and that's what he's saying is, "Oh, how you have fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low." That's Babylon. "You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high." That's kind of what Nebuchadnezzar did, if you remember, back in chapter 4. He said, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High." In other words, I will be a God. And when you hear that, you should hearken back to the Garden of Eden. Because I want you to see this is, runs all through the Bible. Why does it run through the Bible? Because it runs through humanity, fallen humanity. Is what was the sin of Adam and Eve? What did Satan promise them? If you eat this apple, you will be like God. And he doesn't want you to be like him. That's why he doesn't want you to eat this apple. It was a lie. But what was the temptation? If I eat this, I'll be a God. Well, that's what he's talking about here. He said, "You think you are a god, but you are brought down to Sheol, death, to the far reaches of the pit." So this is a prophecy in 700 BC about the king of Babylon, who isn't even a big deal yet, and it's going to come true in this chapter. But the interesting thing is that the Bible often conflates these characters. Were you talking about Satan, or are you talking about the king of Babylon? Yes, exactly. They both have the exact same issue. And when we are filled with pride, we are little Satans, so to speak. I mean, in a metaphorical sense. And so that's just a fascinating prophecy, but it comes true in this. As a matter of fact, in terms of prophecy, prophesying the end of the Babylonian kingdom, once again, this prophecy in Isaiah is 700 BC, and remember, we're in 539 BC. He says, God says of Cyrus, Cyrus is the king of the Persians in 539. How Isaiah knows this 160 years before is really hard to explain if you don't actually believe there's a God and that this is inspired. But he says, he spoke to Cyrus. Cyrus is my shepherd. He will fulfill my purpose. And he will let the Jews go back, which he did in 538 BC. And of the temple, you can rebuild it, which he said, yes, you can. In fact, I'll give you some money to rebuild it. Thus, the Lord says to his anointed Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him. He's going to conquer the Babylonians. Daniel himself, in 553 BC, of course, he's alive in this story. Remember, this is going to come true in 539. But he prophesies, this is the second half of the book, which we're going to dive into. "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel," in which he sees this vision, and we'll decode these visions. But basically, he sees this ram standing on the bank, and it has two horns, and that's Persia. And it's the Medes, so called usually Media is the name of it. And so these two nations, a ram with two horns, and they're going to destroy the king of Babylon. So God is signaling ahead of time what he's going to do, even before the Babylonians become great. So this idea of pride is so misplaced, because pride basically says we can determine our future, but it's actually God that's determining our future. None of us can predict what's going to happen, certainly not 160 years in the future. I can barely predict what's going to happen to me tomorrow. You know, I have plans, but I really don't know what's going to happen. And here's God predicting all of this. If you remember chapter 2, that's the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, of the statue with the head of gold and the chest of silver and the torso of bronze and the iron feet. And Daniel says, this is the next four kingdoms all the way up to Jesus. So God is demonstrating his sovereignty, that he's the one in charge. And you have contrasted with that human beings who want to be in charge. So this is a battle of wills. So immediately, as he starts to drink out of these cups, saying, look at us, we're so good, and Yahweh must not be a very good God, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall in the king's palace. I'm going to stop there for opposite the lampstand. This is kind of interesting archaeologically. Can't prove this, but it's really interesting. So immediately he sees this disembodied human hand start to write in the plaster on the wall. And the interesting thing about this is, in Babylon, there has been unearthed, and it's been a while, and it's conjectured to be the palace complex. It's like 350 yards long, 200 yards wide, huge palace complex. And in there is a big banquet hall that's 170 feet long, think half a football field, and like 56 feet wide. I mean, it's a massive hall. It had plaster walls, and it had places in the wall for lampstands. So I'm not telling you that it has been found, that exact room, but the archaeologists who found it thought it was the exact room because it just matches up so well, right? So he's having this banquet in this huge room, and a disembodied hand starts writing on the wall. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Now, I want you to see how quickly this changes. One verse ago, he was partying, drinking out of the gold goblets of Yahweh from the temple. And now he's hoping his depends hold up. He is so scared, right? It says, the king's color changed, his thoughts alarmed him, his limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. This guy is scared to death, which I'm good with that. If you see a disembodied human hand start writing on the wall, you go, whoa, I have had way too much to drink, except everybody else saw it too, right? And he is scared to death. This is just such a God thing. Like, oh, really, you think you're hot stuff? Let me just show you how you're not, and how quickly things get turned upside down. So he gets afraid, and the king called loudly. That's a nice way of saying he screamed to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. He's like, somebody better tell me what's going on. And the king declared to the wise men, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, royal colors, and have a chain of gold around his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. By the way, here's another little historical note. Why the third ruler? Remember Nebuchadnezzar, when he told to Daniel, he said, and you'll be the second. He talked to the wise men, he said, whoever can tell me my dream and interpret it will be second in the kingdom. Why does he say third? Because he's co-regent with his father. It's Nabonidus, Belshazzar, so you would have to be third. It's that little kind of detail that matches the historical record that, honestly, I'm more convinced of the accuracy of the Bible by little things like that than by big things, because you can't know that unless you were there. So he says, you can be third in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed. He got even more pale, and his lords were perplexed. So let me stop for a second. This is clearly a miracle. It's not a vision in his head, because everybody else saw it too. Wise men come in and go, yep, that is a handwriting on the wall. Never saw that before. But why can they not read it? Interesting thing is Hebrew, this is in Aramaic, but just think of it as the same thing for our purposes, is written right to left. And what's written on this wall, if you read this right to left, those words don't make any sense whatsoever. The Jewish tradition was, the reason they couldn't figure it out is they weren't written right to left, they were written top to bottom. Rembrandt must have known that, because when you read these top to bottom, these are the words. Does it make sense? So he was clearly aware of the Jewish tradition, because you have to somehow explain how can the wise men not read this? It's readable. Well, it's not readable right to left. It doesn't make any sense. but if it's top to bottom. And that was the Jewish tradition. And Rembrandt must have known that because that's the way he painted this. The other reason, and this is my personal opinion, is they may have figured out the words, but when we get to what the words say, they're like, I have no idea what that means. And when we get there, you'll realize this is really cryptic. Like, who knows what those words mean? So in any case, they couldn't figure it out. So the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, this could be his wife. This could be Nebuchadnezzar's wife. This could be the queen grandmother. It's possible that she's still alive in 539. So the queen, because she hears all the hubbub, she hears him screaming like a middle school girl, and so she comes into the banquet hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. Like, man up here for a minute. There is a man in your kingdom. And this is why I think this is probably Nebuchadnezzar's wife. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. That's the same phrase Nebuchadnezzar said 50 years earlier. Or, well, not 50 years. He just died 22 years before. But earlier in his life, he had said that about Daniel. In him is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers because of an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding. He can interpret dreams. He can explain riddles. He can solve problems that were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you the interpretation. So they go to find Daniel, who's been retired, right? They put him out. When Nebuchadnezzar dies, he probably gets demoted and set aside. In fact, it is now 64 years after chapter 2. If you just do the math. In chapter 2, he's a young man. King Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm killing all the wise men. And he goes, wait a minute, prays to God, goes in, explains the dream. He's a young man. He's maybe 14, 16, we don't know. Well, it's now 64 years later. Daniel is in his late 70s or his early 80s. So they go find Daniel, and they bring him in, and Daniel was brought before the king. And the king said, are you that Daniel, one of the exiles from Judah, from Israel, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar brought? I have heard that you have the spirit of wisdom. Now, he says, the wise men, the enchanters have been brought in to read this and make known its interpretation, but they could not show me the interpretation, which makes me think they could read it. They just had no idea. What does that mean? They can't show me the interpretation, but I have heard that you can. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you'll be clothed in purple, get a gold chain, and you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom. So Daniel has spent most of his life in Babylon in exile with no thought of whether or not he would ever go back. We do know from later in the book, which we will get to, that he had been reading Jeremiah, the same Jeremiah that's in your Bible, right, that had been written probably 60-some years before this. All right, so he has read the prophecies of Jeremiah, and he realizes that Jeremiah says after 70 years, God says, I will bring you back. And he's like, we have to be getting close, right? And so Daniel is expectant that perhaps he will live to see. He'll never go back, but maybe he'll live to see his people get to go back. So he's kind of living in retirement, and he comes out, and the king says, I need you. And I need you to interpret this. Okay, the next passage, Daniel's answer, is one of my favorite passages in all of the Bible. So here's what Daniel says, and this is what I aspire to. I aspire to get to the age where you can tell even the king or the president, get off my lawn. This is a get off my lawn kind of moment. Okay, so here comes Daniel, and Daniel answered and said, you can keep your stuff for yourself, I don't want it, right? Which is not a politically correct thing to say to the king. You can keep your stuff, and you can give your rewards to somebody else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him its interpretation. But before I do, you young whippersnapper, I'm going to give you a little lecture. This is so good. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, who was twice the man that you are, true, gave him kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. I mean, that came from God. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all the peoples, languages, and nations trembled before him. This is sort of like, remember Nebuchadnezzar? He didn't have a Persian army camped outside his gates. And so he's kind of rubbing it in here a little bit. He said, "He whom he would he killed and whom he would he kept alive," etc. And so he said, "But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened," this happened at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, it is chapter 4, "so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind." This is something that happened 25 or 30 years before, and he's reminding him, by the way, you know the pride that you've got going? Nebuchadnezzar did that too, and you should remember how it worked out for him. I do this with my kids all the time now. Like, it's like, let me just give you a little lecture. And so he said, basically, "You, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you should have known better. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought to you and into your lords, and you drink wine from them, and you've praised your idols of silver and gold." Like, you just provoked the God of heaven. He said, "But you have provoked the God in whose hand is your very life, and whose all of your ways, and you have not honored him." He said, "So that's why he sent this hand to write on your wall." The king's like, "All right, skip all that stuff, old man. Just tell me what this says." He goes, "Not until you get my lecture first." This is interesting, and I want to stop and make just an interesting little point here. The boldness of Daniel is something that I think is God, through all kinds of revivals throughout history, has brought boldness back to the church. And a lot of times you see that boldness in young people, and I think that's awesome. And I'm seeing it in ministries that I get to deal with all over the world. People are very emboldened now, saying we need to speak the gospel and tell and give the world truth. But one thing I want to mention and not have us overlook is I think that the elders, the older people, should be leading the way in this. There's a story, obviously you're going to see Daniel, who has the boldness to speak the truth to the king, and he says, "And if you don't like it, then kill me." But there's a great story from the early church. Eusebius, the church historian, writes about it. There was an old man, he's 86 years old. He was a Christian in 155 AD. So we're in the middle of persecution of the Roman Empire, 155 AD. He's in Turkey, Smyrna, Turkey. You'll know Smyrna from the New Testament, Izmir, Turkey today. And so he's 86 years old, and so they come to town, and they're having everybody swear allegiance to Caesar. And this is, and if you didn't, you got killed. And everybody did, but not the Christians. And so they're killing Christians who won't do this. So they get Polycarp, and they bring him into the amphitheater, and the governor says, "Polycarp, I need you to sacrifice to Caesar." And he goes, "No way is that happening." He says, I'm not going to do it." And so he's like, "Look, it's not cool to kill an old man. You know, that makes us look bad. It's bad PR. It's going to go viral on social media. We don't need this kind of PR." So he said, "I'll tell you what, why don't you just swear by the genius of Caesar?" In other words, he's giving him little ways out of this. And Polycarp says famously, his words are preserved for us. He says, "For 86 years I have been a servant of God. How can I possibly turn my back on the king who saved me?" And he wouldn't do it, and they burned him alive there. So my point is not that you will get burned alive. Okay, that was maybe not the best story. My point is that we're all called to be bold, but I do think sometimes those of us who have been Christians a long time should lead the way in that. So anyway, Daniel does. He's willing to say to the king, you can keep your stuff. I'll tell you what this says, but I'll tell you also why it's happening. It's your pride. And your failure to acknowledge God will always end in judgment. So that's what he says. And he says, this is what's written on the wall. And this is what these words, by the way, say, if you read them top to bottom. Mene, mene, tekel, uparson. And so the words literally mean numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. So you can see why I think the wise men could read it. They just had no idea what in the world is this handwriting, numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. What could that possibly mean? Daniel doesn't hesitate. Daniel says, this is the interpretation. Mene, numbered, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, weighed, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And then your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And so Daniel says, I know what those words mean. They mean that this very night you have been judged by God and you have been found wanting and your kingdom is taken away from you by God. This is really powerful because later that night they really do get conquered, this very night. I mean, historically, this happens this very night. But what's really interesting is here's Daniel coming in and saying, I'm not only going to tell you what's going to happen, I'm going to tell you why it's happening. And by the way, it's going to happen tonight. And here's Belshazzar, and he's sitting in his thing. He's like, it's not going to happen tonight. It's not going to ever happen. Nobody's getting through these walls, right? So he's still holding on to his pride. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed in purple. They gave him a chain of gold, and a proclamation was made that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel went back to watching his show, you know, in his room, like, we're not going to be here very long. That very night, Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. That's an interesting way of saying it. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Darius was about 62 years old. So I put a picture of Babylon in here again. Now remember, there are 17 miles of walls, and they're 40-foot high walls. The outer wall is 25 feet deep with, of course, artillery. I mean, 25 feet deep. You can put artillery up there. You can put anything you want. And then a space and another wall 21 feet deep. I mean, this place is impregnable. But it's interesting that Herodotus and Xenophon, remember the Greek historians, tell us how this place was conquered. What the Persians and the Medes did was, this ran under a wall here. They basically dug a canal and siphoned off the water from the Euphrates River so that, not so it dried up, just so it lowered enough that their soldiers could wade under the wall. Nobody is defending the place because they're all having a party on this very night. And so according to Xenophon and Herodotus, they basically just diverted the river enough that they could wade in and took the place that very night, in one night, the impregnable Babylon. There's another story, though, that rings really true, and this is really interesting. I'll tell you this guy's name. It's going to be spelled differently in different sources, but we're going to call him Gabrias. Gabrias, according to the accounts, Gabrias was a territorial governor under Nabonidus and Belshazzar. So he governed think of him as a governor of a state. I mean, he's governing one of these territories. And he has a son who's a prince, and he goes on a hunting party with Belshazzar, who is the crown prince, right, of Nabonidus. And so all the young men are out hunting, and Belshazzar, in a rage, gets angry and kills Gabrias' son. Gabrias bides his time, and when the Medes and Persians show up, he says, I'm with you guys. and he mobilizes his National Guard, and he joins them, and he goes. And according to the historian tradition, he's the one who led the forces in. He's the one who showed up in that banquet room while Belshazzar's still having the party, and he personally killed Belshazzar to avenge his son. I don't know if that's true, but that's good Hollywood right there. It's good, but that is what the historians say, and it rings true. Honestly, that could easily be true historically, because this is the way things work there a lot. So on that night, that very night, just as Daniel said, Babylon the Great was overthrown. Nobody came over the walls. Nobody knocked their walls down. God decreed that he had taken the kingdom away from Belshazzar, and so it was. And so you get this picture of Belshazzar sitting there completely confident, partying away, flaunting God, and that very night, his whole world changes. And the idea of who's really in control. And that's kind of one of the themes of Daniel. And that is Daniel chapter 5. And one of the beautiful things about it is Daniel chapter 5 is one of the chapters that is so well attested outside the Bible as well. So let me pause for a second. Questions. What questions do we have?
This is going back a little ways, but Daniel's Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, seems very similar to this king, Belshazzar.
Yes.
Is there significance in that?
Is there significance in the similarity of their name? No. But the names are significant because they have the name of their god, and you'll see it later as Baal, but they would spell it Bel. When you go between these languages, a lot of times the spelling seems like these don't match, and they really do match. So Belshazzar is Baal. Baal protect the king, God protect the king. Belteshazzar is a little twist on that, but the fact is that these are all, I would say good Christian names, but they're not Christian. They're good Babylonian god names, right? And so they've all, and so does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all have the name of one of their gods embedded in it. So it's a very Babylonian name. So I don't know that it's coincidence, but they're similar names. But they're the significance is simply that Baal is in the name. Good question.
Back to the writing on the wall. Mm-hmm. Going back to the writing on the wall, is what is the meaning of the word mean being written twice?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know that commentators have a good answer for that. In other words, honestly, the text doesn't say, and we do not know. I think it just has a good cadence to it, right? I mean, that's just my opinion. It's kind of poetic, but that's just an opinion. I don't know that there's any particular significance of which I'm aware. A lot of conjecture, but no one knows why it's done that way. Good question. So that's chapter 5. It is, and again, it's kind of interesting because Daniel was taken to Babylon, honestly, right before Nebuchadnezzar became king in 605. He was still the crown prince. And he conquers Jerusalem. His dad dies. He goes back and gets made king and then comes back and finishes his campaign. And then he's there at the end of Babylon. And so just as the Lord had proclaimed, Babylon has a season. They served God's purpose. And now they're going to be overthrown by Cyrus. Cyrus is going to come in. This isn't the story of Daniel because we're done with Cyrus now. But Cyrus is going to come in and do exactly what God said he was going to do. He's going to come in and say, you Jews can go home. And you can rebuild your town. Think Ezra, Nehemiah, that era, that's coming. And they're going to go back and they're going to build the wall of Jerusalem. And they're going to rebuild the temple. And Cyrus is going to allow that to happen. So it's interesting because you have to ask yourself, well, who's responsible for this history? Is it Nebuchadnezzar doing what he wants and Belshazzar doing what he wants and Darius and Cyrus doing what they want? You're tempted to say this is just the way it worked out. The thing that makes that, to me, compelling is, yeah, except that God called it 150 years before. Does that make sense? It's like you could maybe argue that this is chance, that it all worked out that way. It's really hard to argue its chance when in 700 BC, Isaiah says, oh, by the way, this is what's going to happen. A guy named Cyrus is going to overthrow this kingdom. He's not even born yet. And then Daniel, when he's a young man, says, by the way, there's going to be a kingdom after yours, and then another kingdom, and then another kingdom. And sure enough, it happens that way. The idea of God foreseeing and foretelling this, which brings me to a couple of interesting lessons, and one of them is about prophecy. But first, the first and greatest lesson of this is that God is sovereign. In every one of these, God gives and God takes away for his purposes, even secular realms. And the beauty of that is, it's not that God is only sovereign over godly nations. All of history shows that God is sovereign over godly nations. He's sovereign over kings that don't even acknowledge him. And I think that's important because that's still true in the world today. We tend to think that the evil players on our stage, which for us, you know, you look at the totalitarian rulers in our world, the Xi Jinpings and the Kim Jong-uns and the Vladimir Putins and go on down the list. But you see these totalitarian rulers and you tend to think, well, the only protection we have is we better be a Christian nation. Actually, the only protection you have is that God is sovereign even over them. And that's what this story shows. And that's not just true geopolitically, it's true in your personal life as well. God is even sovereign over your terrible boss. Okay, I mean, God is sovereign over the events in your life. That is the message of Daniel. It's actually the message of the whole Bible, but we're seeing it up front with Daniel. Question?
Yep, back a little bit. Uh-huh. What is the relationship between Darius and Cyrus?
Okay, so Darius is a Mede. So he is an official in the Medes. Cyrus is a Persian. Cyrus is the overall king. Darius is apparently the one who took Babylon. Because there are a lot of battles going on here. It's against the whole empire. And apparently, Gobryas is the guy who actually went in and killed the king. But so Darius was over the army that took that. So Darius is a Mede, Cyrus is a Persian. Then they reuse these names. So you have to be a little bit careful because later there's going to be a famous Darius who is a king of the Persian Empire. It's not this Darius, okay? I know it gets really confusing. They ought to at least put Junior or something, you know, in these names so we can tell. But so it's a Mede and a Persian. That's a good question. Second thing is prophecy fulfilled. And this is interesting as we get ready to go into the prophecy. Why? This is an interesting question. Why does God even do prophecy? I mean, if he's sovereign and things are moving to his plan, he doesn't have to tell you what he's going to do. If he told us or not, I still believe he's sovereign. He is the creator of everything, and he is the one who's actually in charge of this universe. But he chooses to let us know, to reveal to us, because prophecy, the nature of prophecy is it's revealed. It's not something you know inside yourself. It's something you're told you could never know on your own. Isaiah, no way Isaiah even understood what he was prophesying. When he says, God says to Cyrus, he's like, who's Cyrus? God told me to write it. I have no idea who this guy is. It's a revelation, right? But why does God do that? I think God doesn't do that for the people who are hearing the prophecy, maybe to encourage them. Clearly, Jeremiah said, 70 years, and I will bring you back. And that probably was encouraging at the time, that we won't, you know, my grandchildren and great-grandchildren could be free, right? That's encouraging. But I think prophecy is meant for you and me. It is meant so that over time, we can look back and we can say, I know that God is sovereign because not only did he do it, but he foretold it. Does that make sense? I think prophecy is so, and you'll see this phrase a lot, so that you will know that I am God. In other words, I want you to have faith, and I'm going to give you a reason to have faith. I think that the historical veracity of the Bible, the evidence, helps us to trust God that, you know what, this isn't a fairy tale. This is real stuff happening in real history. I think when you read prophecy, you go, God actually said this was going to happen, and we now have the benefit of hindsight and say, and it happened exactly the way he said it was going to happen. I think that's God being gracious to build our faith. That's why I think we even have prophecy, is so that we will know that he is God. And then finally, and this is the one I just really want us to think about. You remember in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, back in chapter 3, they go up before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar's furious, like, you guys are embarrassing me. I got all the rulers out here, and they're all wondering, am I the big dog or not? And if you don't bow down, I'm going to have to kill you. And remember what they said. They said, our God is able to deliver us, and we believe that he will. But even if he does not, we are not going to bow down. It's a powerful statement of faith. They knew that God was able. They did not know if God was willing to do that in that moment. Same as Jesus, Garden of Gethsemane. Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass me by. But not my will, but your will be done. You do what's best. The beauty for us is that Romans 8:28 is one of the passages that we should hold on to. In all things, all circumstances, God works for good for those who love him, are called according to his purpose. And the point is that God is working for good for you. And none of us think that means, oh, he's working really hard to make sure nothing unpleasant ever happens to you. We're not children. We know that's not what that says. But we know that he is working everything in our life for good. With the ultimate goal of God is build our faith and we will be with him for eternity. And so we can trust that God will do it. Not only part of the reason that this is all written down is so that you will know that he is able and you will know that he is willing. God loves you and he will work for good in your life. He will not work for comfort, because I have to say that comfort is harder on my faith sometimes than difficulties are. And that's what God prizes. The currency of God is faith. And if comfort serves that, then you will be comfortable. And if discomfort builds your faith, then you will be uncomfortable. It's just like raising your children. You will do what's ultimately good for them, not what pleases them in the moment, because you love them that much. So this, in Daniel, I really think you see that God is, he's really going out of his way to convince you that I am able to do anything. Anything is possible with God. And he says, and I am willing. I know who you are. I know where you are. You are my people, and I will guide you. That's the story of Daniel. Daniel gets an eyewitness view of God's judgment of Israel with the Babylonians, and then Babylon being brought low, and the savior, if you will, of the Jews coming in the person of Cyrus. I think you see that play out over and over again in Christian history. If you look at the early church, you realize God did the same thing, that God allowed persecution, and the persecution that God allowed, because the Roman emperors decided, we're just going to stamp out the church. And by all accounts, they had the power to do it, and they did everything they could to do it. And what happened? Backfired massively. They killed a lot of Christians who are now living in eternity with God, and the church exploded. And so you see the same thing over and over and over, is God using what looks like the darkest circumstances, and then you can see that, oh my goodness, God did work this out for good. But when you're in the middle of it, it's hard to see, and that's why we study the book of Daniel, and that's why you have the book of Daniel, is to remind you he's done it before, and he will do it again. Amen? Next is probably one of my favorite stories. This is the end of the stories. Okay, it's chapter 6. The Babylonians are not in control anymore. Now the Medes and the Persians are in control. Daniel's an old man, and his enemies decide now is finally, I mean, they hate this guy, right? They hate him. Why? Because he serves God. And they said, now's our chance to get the old man. We're going to kill him. And they do their best, throw him into the lion's den. But what I want to do is I want to look at this story. And I think here's my point. There's more to this story than we realize. And so we'll finish the life of Daniel. Daniel probably dies shortly after this event, right? I mean, HMOs were only so good back then. He's in his 80s. He's already exceeded the average lifespan. So next week, we'll finish the life of Daniel by looking at the lion's den. I'll see you then.